Today we're going to look at one of my favorite miracle stories, the healing of the bent woman in Luke 13, verses 10 to 17. But first, Jane and I, when she was visiting me for a month in Boston, talked a lot about miracles and African understanding of miracles and just sort of what to do with all these biblical miracle stories, because I do think that we Americans don't tend to think in the same mentality as Bible people do, and that sometimes that makes it harder for us to understand the miracle stories, the healings. And so we talked about doing a session together and hearing some stories from Jane about miracles in the countries in which she's worked and how healing is viewed there. And so she's going to start us out here.
Well, what I was seeing was that in the countries where I lived, if somebody is sick, the question that is usually asked is why. For example, we know what causes malaria. There's a good disease. Do we know?
Mosquitoes.
Right. The bite of the Anopheles mosquitoes transmits a certain virus, and that's what we get sick with. But okay, you're sitting there, I'm sitting there. The mosquito comes and bites me. Well, why? Why does the mosquito bite me and not you? That's the kind of questions that the people I lived with would ask. And I think in our scientific way of looking at things, although I realized in the last session, perhaps we're not always as
scientific as you would like.
Well, no, but you know, it's simply not asking the question why. But I would simply say it was chance. You know, I mean, that just happened to be where the mosquito was. People could also say that God sent that disease for some reason. The Zairians that I lived with would say that probably most of the time somebody had sent that mosquito. Somehow through the spirits, I was out of line in some way. I had broken the bonds that link us as a community. It's usually a family member, usually an uncle, seems to be the most common. If I somehow haven't lived up to my obligations to my uncle through receiving him in the right way or giving him a certain amount of money, if I've married the wrong person, if in any way I haven't fulfilled my community obligations, he could be very likely to send a disease on me in some way. So even if we find that chloroquine or quinine or something like that works to heal that disease, the point is that there was a reason that disease was sent. So there are spirits always working in our world, and our goal is to have power over those spirits. And that the good news, in a place like Zaire, is that Jesus is more powerful than these evil spirits. That was very hard for me to get into over the years that I was there, because that's not my idea of the good news. It's not what I'm looking for in life. I never think about evil spirits, but I still need that good news. But I think most people in Africa, the word they use when they talk about God and the good news is power. Through Jesus, we have power over all these things. In Senegal, where I worked a longer time and I just got back from, most people are Muslim, and there are Islamic religious teachers that heal with a variety of methods. The most common seems to be that if I'm sick and I go to an Islamic religious teacher, he will write certain verses from the Quran, the holy book, that relate to my sickness in some way. Wash those off the tablet. It's written on a wooden tablet. And with that water that was used for washing, I will wash myself. And then I will be healed through the power of
ink.
God's word. The Quran is more God's revelation than the Bible. I mean, we see the primary revelation of God in the person of Jesus Christ. And the Bible is written about that story, but the Quran for them in Arabic, never in a translation. If the Quran is translated, it's no longer the Quran. But anyway, right in the book itself, there's the power of God is revealed in the Arabic book, so that is the kind of things that heal us. People go to hospitals for certain kinds of diseases in a place like Senegal, but certain kinds of diseases, certain kinds of situations, they would only go to an Islamic teacher. And one of the main ways that Islamic teachers have power is through their healings. Their teachings are listened to if they are successful at healing people. That shows that they have the blessing of God. I mean, it's not, they don't necessarily see a power in themselves, but they are able to call the blessing of God down. If I'm sick, obviously I need God's blessing to be healed. And that teacher, or that sort of like a priest, has more power to call down God's blessing than I can on my own. So I go to him to get the blessing of God for healing. So just to say that healing is, the idea of healing outside of medicines, as which I would probably use, is very, very strong in Africa today. And anyone who works in Africa has to take that seriously. And I think there are some lessons for us here.
Now when it's in Arabic, and he writes it in Arabic, does he translate it at all to the person he's working with?
It doesn't matter what it means. The power is in the writing itself.
So he doesn't choose, or she or whatever, doesn't choose a certain verse for appropriateness. It's just
no, I believe that it's somehow appropriateness, but it doesn't have to do with the meaning. It's that that verse is the correct verse, but not because of what it means.
How does it work? I mean, does it really work?
Yeah.
This is interesting.
This is very interesting.
Does it really work? People are healed.
Mm-hmm.
There was a question up there.
That was my question too. Does it work statistically? Has anyone done any studies to see if that kind of healing does work?
I haven't heard of any studies. I know some people who did not get healed. That I can say.
But then, of course, that was because they didn't have faith, right?
Well, no, I don't know. But then they weren't healed in the hospital either, you know? So what are you going to say? Statistically, I don't know. Some healing methods work sometimes, and they don't at other times.
All right, let's look at this text, and then we can come back to some of these questions. I was just saying in the first session, a tape I would really recommend to you, if you want to listen to any tapes here, this one has been, I was here when he first gave the session, John DiGrucci, who is the father of Janelle, who gave Matins today. He's probably the foremost white South African theologian working against apartheid today. I mean, he's very prominent, a wonderful author. We've got a number of his books in the store and a great speaker on the whole situation of apartheid and our theology. He's got probably his best known as Apartheid as Heresy. But anyway, for me, it was really moving to meet him and learn that he's not only a person who works against apartheid, but he also has a healing ministry. And he said that he got converted to this whole idea of healing and the importance of that in the gospel by African Christians with whom he worshipped and worked, who said, look, you know, what use is it to believe in Jesus and not believe the miracles, and not believe that the miracles, which are such a prominent part of Jesus' ministry in the Bible, are still happening today? And so he talks about his own struggle with it, how at first he was really reluctant and really apologetic and everything to believe that any of this was possible, but then has gotten more into seeing healing as a really important part of our ministry, which also, of course, includes justice, work for justice and everything like that. So this is the name of that tape. Okay, let's look at Luke 13, verses 10 to 17. Somebody want to read the story here?
Might have been in the International.
Well, let's get an RSV, since most of you have the black Bibles.
I hear. Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues in the Sabbath, and there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity for 18 years. She was bent over and could not fully straighten herself. And when Jesus saw her, he called her and said to her, Woman, you are freed from your infirmity. And he laid his hands upon her, and immediately she made straight, and she praised God. But the ruler of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day. Then the Lord answered him, You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his ass from the manger and lead it away to water it? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 years, be loosed from this bound on the Sabbath day? As he said this, all his adversaries were put to shame, and all the people rejoiced at all the glorious things they were done by him.
Uh, Well, I think the story has a lot of directions we could go with it. I'll just point out a few of them, and then we'll see where the discussion leads us. The first one probably to talk about is the whole idea of Sabbath. This is one of three Sabbath healing controversy stories that Luke has in his gospel. And more than any of the other gospels, Luke talks about Sabbath healing, Jesus' Sabbath healing, and the controversy it generated. This story is unique to Luke. We don't find it in Matthew, Mark, or John. And there's also another Sabbath healing controversy at the beginning of chapter 14, right after this, the healing of the man with dropsy, who I never knew what dropsy was, but it's a swelling. You're all swollen up with edema. Anyway, so Luke somehow seems to have concentrated Jesus' healing work on the Sabbath more than any other gospel. He starts right out in chapter 4 with the healing of Peter's mother-in-law, which takes place on the Sabbath. That one is the only one that doesn't generate a great controversy. But right after that, in Luke 6, the healing of the man with the withered hand, the withered right hand, is the first Sabbath healing controversy. And from then on, Jesus seems to heal disproportionately on the Sabbath. I mean, it's not just like 1/7 of his healings take place on the Sabbath, you know, sort of like you'd expect a statistical average of healing, you know, certain percentage for each day of the week. It's like he especially waited for the Sabbath or something and then healed a lot of people on the Sabbath. And this generated a lot of controversy. You were allowed in Jewish law to save a life on the Sabbath. And certainly childbirth took place on the Sabbath. You know, the extraordinary kinds of things could take place. But the scandal here is that these were people with chronic illnesses. This woman has been bent over for 18 years. And couldn't he have waited one more day to heal her? But no, he picks the Sabbath to heal her. Same thing with the man with dropsy. He didn't just, you know, swell up in one day and was ready to explode, and so he had to be healed. It was an ongoing illness which he had, and Jesus picked the Sabbath to heal him. And the man with the withered hand, same thing. You know, it was a chronic complaint, and then he picks the Sabbath and heals him. And I think Luke is trying to convey there's something special about the Sabbath, that it, more than any other day, was the appropriate day for healing. It's not just sort of chance that caused Jesus to do all this healing on the Sabbath, but it was sort of somehow the true meaning of the Sabbath in the eyes of Luke, that Jesus did all these healings on that particular day. I'd like to go back a little bit to the Old Testament meaning of the Sabbath to try to discover, now, why would this be? Why would Jesus do more healings on the Sabbath? What's special about the Sabbath that he would somehow understand it as the best day to do healings? And let's look at a couple passages that tell why the Sabbath came about. The first in Exodus 20. Page 63. Good. This is good. Tell us the page numbers. We don't have to look for these books. Page 63 in the front of your black Bible. Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. If somebody would read this to us.
Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, or your son or your daughter, your manservant or your maidservant, or your cattle or your sojourner, or who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it.
Okay, so it's linked to creation here, the fact that God created the world in 6 days and then rested on the Sabbath day, on the seventh day. So when we rest, we are reflecting God's own rest, what's going on in heaven or wherever, that God is resting. And our rest, even the animals get a rest here too, isn't that neat? And the slaves, the resident aliens, everyone is to rest on the seventh day as a reflection of God's creation. And I think we can think about that in terms of our summer theme. For example, this summer, the idea of you want to incarnate on earth a reflection of what heaven would be like and try to live that out in our daily life. And that's what the Sabbath is a reminder of each week. Then there's another explanation given for the Sabbath command in Deuteronomy 5. Let's look at that one also. I think this is on page 156. Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 to 15 gives a little different version of why we keep the Sabbath. Somebody want to read these verses, 12 to 15?
Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, or your manservant or your maidservant, or your ox or your ass, or any of your cattle, or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your manservant and your maidservant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day.
So here, what is it that why the Sabbath? What's the reminder here? It's not creation, it's...
Keep it holy.
Yeah, keeping it holy, but why?
Release from Egypt.
Yeah, it's a remembrance of Egypt and of that whole release from the bondage in Egypt. So the idea being that each day, each week, when you come to the seventh day, that is a day of rest that reminds you of the great liberation from Egypt, that you were once in bondage and are now free. And so two kind of different explanations for the Sabbath here, one rooting it in creation, the other rooting it in the Exodus, both of which then would have been still operating in Jesus' day, in New Testament times, recalling God's mighty acts. It's a day of praise of God, where you're freed up. You know, you might talk to an Orthodox Jew, and it sounds sort of oppressive sometimes, the things they have to do. They can't turn on a light, they can't light a fire, they can't cook their food on the Sabbath, can't ride in a car, all of which are kindling a fire, you know, the spark that starts the engine. But actually, it's most of all the sense of liberation and freedom, that you rest from these, from work. You rest from any kind of work. You don't carry things that day in order to be freed up to praise God and to spend it as a day of rejoicing. You don't have to live a rat race kind of life like you do the rest of the week. It's a day of freedom from all that. And that would be how it would be viewed in Jesus' time also. Okay, Jesus then takes upon himself, though, authority over the Sabbath. That's the scandal, the great scandal. He is claiming basically to be God here and to be Lord over the Sabbath. He specifically said that in Luke chapter 6, and you can imagine that it was offensive to people. It certainly would be... you know, you can understand that here he is, you know, the Sabbath is a day of remembering God and of remembering creation and the Exodus. And suddenly, you've first got Jesus saying it in Luke chapter 6 here, where he and his disciples go through the grain fields and on the Sabbath, and they pick the ears of grain, which would be considered work, and you couldn't do that. And they challenge him on that. The religious authorities say, "Why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And Jesus answers by likening himself, first of all, to King David and saying, well, don't you remember how King David violated the Sabbath also? And then he culminates by saying, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So he's claiming to be Lord of the Sabbath. And then he goes right on to heal the guy with the withered hand here. So this is a really important aspect of Luke's understanding of Jesus, is Lord of the Sabbath, who is specially called to heal people on the Sabbath day. And the healing of this woman in Luke 13 is no coincidence that it's on the Sabbath. You can see that a little bit here in the dialogue itself between Jesus and this, it's the leader of the synagogue, right? Yeah, in verse 14, the leader of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, there are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured, and not on the Sabbath. And this word ought to be done is the little Greek word day, or it is necessary. It is necessary to work on 6 days. But Jesus answers right back in verse 16, ought not this woman, and that's the exact same word, it is necessary. Is it not necessary that this woman, a daughter of Abraham, be freed from bondage on the Sabbath day? So it's two clashing views here of what is necessary. The leader of the synagogue says it is necessary to work on 6 days, and Jesus comes right back with, is it not necessary that this woman be healed on the Sabbath? And you can see why they were opposing each other here. Now, just a little bit about these words. I think Jesus is using here, or Luke is using, a lot of words that are trying to remind us of this whole idea of Exodus and liberation. And that's one thing that's so wonderful about this story, is it talks about healing, but it's also using images of liberation. Unbinding is what he keeps saying here. You unbind your ox at the manger, right? This woman whom Satan has bound. The word for binding is deo, is the verb, and the word for unbinding or loosing or releasing, liberating, is luo. And these two words in various forms, in Greek you can add on prepositions on the beginning and of either one of them to do a little variety here, but these two words, luo, unbind, release, with recollections of the Exodus and the liberation there, and then this other word, deo, and binding and being in bondage and being bound, are being used over and over in this text as if to sort of shake us into remembering the whole sense of the liberation as an unbinding and a releasing, and somehow that's what's taking place in Jesus' healing of this woman, is the true fulfillment of the Exodus story and of the true meaning of the Sabbath, as Deuteronomy tells us, that it's the day in which you remember that you were released from bondage in Egypt, and that's still what's going on in Jesus' work on the Sabbath. Any comments here? We could also talk about the fact that in verse 16 he says it's Satan who's binding her. You know, talk about illness in our life or in our world. Is our sicknesses bondage of Satan, and what are the pros and cons of that understanding of them? Thinking about your experience in Zaire and your own experiences with illness, is it helpful to think of it that way? Or there's certainly some pitfalls, right? It's better than blaming the victim, right? I mean, that at least you're blaming Satan here. You're not blaming the woman for having sinned and therefore being bent over. You know, like sometimes we say AIDS is some, we don't say hopefully, but some people say, you know, it's God's punishment for bad conduct. You know, that's not the image here. It's saying that Satan bound her.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'd want to bring up. I mean, I was just assuming that most Americans, I think, like me, don't think to ask the question why. I mean, we ask how. How did that particular disease enter us? I mean, through what means? If it's pneumonia, perhaps there was some,
you know, smoking.
Or something. But it never occurs to me to say, you know, why? Why is this person sick and this one isn't? I don't think. But people in the first session said, yes, we do ask it. So I'd be curious about your reactions to that.
I think religious people tend to ask it. Aren't they always saying, you know, why me, God? Why are you doing this to me? It seems pretty common to me from people who have faith in God.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that?
I don't know. I might in a situation.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
in
how,
a
yeah,
desperate
true.
Situation.
Yeah.
But I don't think that I would. That's not really my understanding, but it seems pretty common to me to see that among people who have kind of a standard faith.
You made a statement just now, people who have faith in God. Sometimes I think the people that ask why are the ones that do not have enough faith in God.
That can be.
And so they're asking the question because there's something missing in their life.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
So I would respond a little differently. I think the question why is often a very natural part of grieving, the experience of loss, and not necessarily connected with one's particular religious orientation, but just I think there is oftentimes a loss of meaning when we experience some negative experience, such as disease, either our own or someone we love. And then I think there may not be an expectation of an answer to that question, but it's a real natural question to ask at that point.
I was asked that by my 14-year-old daughter by me, just because, you know, it's kind of the shock. I don't know if I gave the right response. I just said, we live in an imperfect world, and so these things do happen. And it could be somebody else, or it could be me. But, yeah.
It seems like often a skeptic's question to a Christian is one of why is there so much suffering, or why or is such a good person suffering so much? And that seems like a pretty common question to me.
Well, not just skeptics either. I mean, I think we as Christians need to take that really seriously too, of why is there so much suffering in the world, and what does that say about our vision of God's realm? What were you saying, Pam?
Well, I was just thinking there's books written about it, like why bad things happen to good people. So it's a question that comes up a lot.
I guess I'm also convinced that there is such a thing as evil. I think particularly as I've worked with children who've been suffering, that's been a sense for me that a disease, I experience that as a real evil force, evil power. Think of a little boy who had been a very normal, healthy little boy, and then contracted meningitis, and was going to be brain damaged from that. That seems like there was an evil force at work in it.
Like Satan, I mean, if you want to call it Satan or something. Uh-huh. Yeah. Satan's bondage. Uh-huh.
Another point of view that I've heard, I haven't thought a whole lot about, but strikes me as worth thinking about, is that we tend to view these occurrences in the world as though we were the center of God's attention, I guess, as though, I don't know exactly how to say it, maybe somebody can help me, as though because these things are happening to us, they are evil, as opposed to that they're happening within the context of all of creation, and that there may be other points of view. I'm not saying it quite well enough, but...
But what about then even something like, I mean, yeah, it does seem like we're sort of self-centered, but on the other hand, I mean, there's this one deer out here, I keep thinking about him, that hurt his leg. I think he has a broken leg, his front left one, And, you know, what about something like that? Why does a deer have to have a hurt foot? I mean, it's not just us. There's a lot of evil about in creation or sickness, too.
But that's still viewing it from our meanings. It's evil because we interpret it that way. We see it that way. Our meanings are still created within our limited experience and within our experience of what it is to be human. And all of creation and all of God's realm is bigger than that and contains more meaning than that.
I would also so much, well, there is so much evil in the world, but God is over all, and His will, does He allow it? So He allows it. For instance, Job is such an example for me, that God says to the devil, you can do everything with him, but you cannot kill him. And so, I mean, God's will is in everything. So he lets, does he let...
torture, he permits torture in that story.
Yeah.
Well, we can hear you.
Oh, sorry.
Well, if you believe that God is omnipotent and omniscient, then you have to, well, I have to assume that everything that happens is
in the realm of God. And that I believe the term every cloud has a silver lining is not without exception. I really think that all of the suffering, there is some reason for it. In, even with the deer, that we're to be more compassionate towards it, possibly help it. That there's something for everyone to learn in all the bad stuff that happens.
This gal mentioned Job, so I had looked at it previously and said, I think that's the key here. Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. Now, Jesus Christ, though he didn't call him Jesus Christ, the Lord of heaven and earth, had become his personal, private, personal Lord. And I think that's what Jesus Christ is after in all of our lives. Like Paul, he sought the Lord three times that whatever that problem was he had, it might be removed. But Jesus said, no, my grace is sufficient for you, that you might be dependent upon me and find your sufficiency in me.
And more importantly, that there's a sense in which God's power can be even more manifest in his infirmity, infatuation. Yeah, that's pretty scary to think that God could want us to live with disabilities in order to learn the power of God even more.
In the Old Testament, when we are told that when Adam and Eve, so-called sin, they were told, for God said, now they are like us, they know good and evil. To me, I can't visualize a person like a Satan out there somewhere. I think the good and evil is right here within me. And this is where the evil comes forth in the world from each one of us. Take a man like Hitler. He allowed that power of darkness within himself to be so great that to me he exemplified evil at its height. But we all have that evil in us, the same as Hitler had. But we also have the light, which evidently Hitler never found. But it's whether or not one is going to overcome the other. So the battle is within each one of us. Are we going to allow the darkness to overcome the light, or the light to overcome the darkness? Can the two come together and live like parable, leave the weeds in with the wheat, leave them alone. At the end, they will be separated.
Okay, you and then you. Oh, you've been waiting longer? Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Jake.
To that, it's just, I'm not sure. The evil may be within us and the good, but that doesn't exactly explain. Evil just seems to happen, that it's not, you know, or unjust things that happen, you know? Like the deer breaking his leg. No man probably did that. It probably just happened. Is that just, and then unjust things that happen, or apparently unfair things that happen in nature, are those aren't evil, though. It's just the way things are.
Just an
act
of nature.
Well, in that one of the early Bible studies earlier this week, when they were talking about the Lord's Prayer and the explanation of deliver us from evil, I think there to me was an acknowledgement that evil does exist, and what we're asking God is to give us a strength through that evil to never forsake Him, you know, to be above that no matter what the trials are. But He did acknowledge that it was evil. Mm-hmm. But just that we were praying for the strength to overcome your regard.
Yeah. And God gave us the consciousness so that we know what is in a way, you know. But there's always, that constant battle.
Well,
you know.
Okay. I've always asked myself, if I was faced with some of the pressures that people have been under, Hitler, for instance, when that maybe your whole family might suffer something from your actions. I pray that God, I guess, gives you the direction, helps you to remain strong no matter what.
Boy, it sounds like there's a lot of energy on this whole question. All right, Ron, I want to go on with the text, too.
No, you go on, because I had an entirely different
question. Oh, you had an entirely different question about this?
No, about the original discussion of spirit healing.
Okay, go ahead.
The theme for the last 2 weeks, one of the major themes has been care for the environment. And one of the things that environmentalists are bringing up more is a re-spiritization of the world. That what science has done in its effort to gain control over the world and provide all these so-called wonderful things that we have is to take the spirit that I think the people that you were describing still believe in, that the world is inhabited by spirits. As Dan Erlander, our Bible teacher from the last couple of weeks, that there's another dimension to reality in addition to the material dimension that we so much live in, and that's a spiritual dimension, and that Western culture has lost that spirit dimension, and this allows us to be very callous with the environment because it's just stuff for us to manipulate. And so there's an effort among environmentalists to breathe back that sacred spiritual quality to the environment. And what you were talking about raised that, and it's going on in medicine today with people in Western culture being more and more interested in alternative modes of healing and looking to Eastern culture and looking to non-drug, non-surgery methods of healing. And so it's really an alive issue, and it raised all kinds of questions for me about the promises and dangers of that. In a way, it's scary to think of people trying to heal themselves through what might be called superstition. On the other hand, there seems to be great promise in that too.
And certainly medically, more and more doctors are starting to realize that if you really want to help someone find healing, you involve the family, you involve relationships, you involve these dimensions. I mean, it's happening not only in sort of para-medicine, but also right in the heart of medicine today.
Especially with cancer. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to, this conversation, obviously there's a lot of lively thoughts here. Maybe we can continue on some of this at coffee break too, because I think when you start talking about where does evil come from and how does it fit into the world, boy, we all have ideas about that, and really important ones. Just a few more points about the text that I think are interesting. First of all, this business, we talked in the first session about what is it at the end of the passage here that put his opponents to shame in Jesus' response. Was it his incredible logic sort of saying each of you unties your ox or your ass and leads it to water? You know, the idea of you have compassion for your animals on the Sabbath, can you not also have compassion for this woman who has been tied by Satan these 18 years? And that his analogy is so powerful. Another thing that he says in this line in verse 16, he reminds the people that this woman is a daughter of Abraham. And this is a phrase that Jesus only uses a couple times in the gospel, and it's always used when people around him start thinking of someone as an outcast and imply sort of by their actions toward that person that this wasn't really a daughter of Abraham or a son of Abraham. The other person about whom he says this, and it's interesting, in the Gospel of Luke, oftentimes men and women are paired. You'll have a story about a man and a story about a woman right next to each other, like we talked yesterday about the lost coin and the lost sheep. One is a woman and one is a man who loses it. Here, this expression, a daughter of Abraham or a son of Abraham, there's a parallel man about whom Jesus says this in Luke 19. It's Zacchaeus, who, you know, is the worst of the tax collectors, just awful, extremely rich man and short, you know, who climbs up in the tree to see him. Jesus sees him, invites him. He says, I've got to go eat at your house. And Zacchaeus gives, you know, sort of repents of his money grubbing and gives half of his goods to the poor and provides restitution to anyone whom he's defrauded. And Jesus says to him, to Zacchaeus, who other people thought of as a terrible outcast, a really evil man. Today, salvation has come to this house because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost. That whenever we kind of identify people as outcasts or the people of Jesus' time, Jesus is going to go right to that person and say, this too is a daughter of Abraham. This too is a son of Abraham. And the Son of Man came precisely for these people to seek and to save the lost. And so I think that's kind of neat that Jesus reminds the people that she too is a daughter of Abraham, bound by Satan for 18 years. Another thing I think is interesting to talk about with this is the image, the different postures that are talked about in this text. And I guess because I've seen it acted out as a skit by a group of women, it was really powerful to think about the different postures that this woman has been, you know, bent over for 18 years, cannot straighten herself up. This, too, is the curse given to the snake in Genesis 3. This idea that, I mean, I don't know if snakes originally walked around on legs or what, but the fact that now the snake has to slither on the ground is given as a curse in Genesis 3. Now, whatever you think of this myth, somehow there is an evil or a punishment associated with the idea of having to creep along and have this sort of bent over posture here, which the snake has, in which this woman is all bent over by an evil force or by the sin of the world and needs liberation from that. And the verb that is used for straighten up here in verse 11, and in verse 13, in verse 11 it says, she was bent over and was quite unable to stand up straight. And then also in verse 13, when he laid his hands on her, immediately she stood up straight and began to praise God. I wrote the verb on the board here. It's anakupsai. Ana means up. So anakupsai. And straighten yourself up. This is used only one other place in the Gospels. And I think it's a really key word. So let's look at that other passage and see what are some of the overtones that go with that verb. It's in Luke 21, it's in verse 28, but we'll read Luke 21, verses 27 and 28. Just a few chapters later. So it's the same author, Luke, using the verb again. Does somebody want to read these two verses? This is, just to say by way of preface, this is in what you call Jesus' apocalyptic discourse, when he's talking about the end time, when the Son of Man will return and the end of the world will come, the kingdom of God dawns here on earth, and the redemption that is inaugurated in Jesus is brought to completion too. And so he's describing what will happen. Does somebody want to read 27 and 28?
And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to take place, look up and raise your hand, because your redemption is drawing near.
Okay, and you only have look up, but that's the word. And I've got to translate here in this New Revised Standard is stand up. So it's this idea that there's a posture that you assume when you see this great day dawning of the fulfillment of all redemption. And the posture you assume is this looking up, this standing up, this rising up, that this woman already is experiencing here in her healing in Luke 13. This is anakupsata, the imperative, stand up at this point. And so I think it's kind of wonderful the way that she, who has been so bent over now, is experiencing the end time a little before the rest of us. In her healing, it's a sign of this end time, which we will all experience one day, but which she now is inaugurating in her own standing up. It's not just, you know, standing up. It's like standing up to receive God's greatness. And I mean, it has this posture that she is told to assume has a special sort of theological meaning almost here, in that this is what you're told to do when the great day dawns. Sort of.
I think all sickness and all imperfection is our opportunity to acknowledge where true life and true power and true purity comes from. And see, God is searching after those with the perfect heart, because all of us will, if we trust in Jesus Christ, we'll have a perfect body someday. But in the meantime, he's perfecting our hearts. And So he allows, I mean, in Paul's life, that imperfection was so that probably Paul wouldn't be overconfident and cocky, because he had a lot of gifts. And, you know, he could easily get centered on himself and forget where it all came from. So the Lord was keeping him and keeping his perspective proper, is that keeping Paul's eyes on where his strength and power was really coming from.
Yeah.
So as long as we have that tendency to give ourselves glory and not the Lord, I think he allows these disciplines, I think.
Yeah, I think there's different views of that, though. I agree, and the Pauline passages are really important to me, especially in thinking about people who aren't healed, or why disability is allowed to continue in the world. But I don't see that same thing in the Gospels. I think in the Gospels, Jesus always reaches out to heal. There's no sense of sort of leaving some people sick in order to help them experience God. You know, I mean, Jesus always reaches out to heal. That's the whole gesture of the Gospels, is that it's God's will for people to be healed. So there are, I would say there are different views in the Bible on this, and that they're all important. But that Luke's is a little different from Paul's, I think, here.
I don't think your view has to contrast with his necessarily, because Jesus' ministry could be showing that through the gospel, then we can be healed, though. And I mean, not just physically. So I don't think it necessarily has to be, you know, two contradictory views.
Yeah, and thank goodness that we do have Paul there too, because there are certainly in our day a lot of people who don't experience the kind of healing that you might think they would. And otherwise the tendency would be, you know, well, what's wrong with you? Don't you have enough faith that you're not getting healed? And we can point to Paul, who clearly had a lot of faith and still wasn't healed too. So that is really important.
The Lord is very compassionate. He won't allow more than we can handle.
Yeah.
But take Johnny Erickson, this gal that was such an athlete, and who then became paralyzed from the neck down. And she is totally thankful for what happened in her life, because she wouldn't have made the spiritual progress. But not everybody's like she is.
I have some difficulty with that. That seems to make God into some kind of manipulator.
Mm-hmm.
I guess personally, I can't buy that.
I can't either.
Dan?
I guess where I come down is somewhere in the Pauline stuff, of not that God is either choosing or not choosing to cause evil or suffering to teach us lessons or not, but that in every situation there is the possibility of working good out of evil. Mm-hmm. Just starting with the starting point of acknowledging evil and naming it for what it is, and that there is the possibility of working good or healing in that. And we can't always say what kind of healing that's going to be. Sometimes it may be a physical healing, other times it may be a reconciliation with either the physical state or with family members and so forth. But we all, I think, have experiences of some great evil that I just don't think there's any explanation for, and I would never want to claim that God is somehow causing it to, or I guess I would disagree with your statement that God never gives more, allows more to happen than we can handle, because my experience of being in El Salvador, I've seen entire villages massacred. It's just, I cannot reconcile that at all with a God who would say, well, I didn't allow anything more to happen than they could handle. And yet, even in situations when there's entire villages massacred, I mean, I think it is name that for evil, and then also recognize that God is, in God's compassion, present there, and there is the possibility for some healing or good to come out of that, but it never takes away the evil that's already happened, mm-hmm. at least the way I understand it.
Okay, well, I thought we could just end with a little more insights from Africa here. Jane, do you want to tell some story? When we were having these discussions about miracles in Boston, we didn't just confine our discussions to healing, although that's principally what this text is about, but some sort of other fascinating stories that she has of people who see the power of God at work in all kinds of interesting ways, shall we say. And do you want to tell someone else?
Do you think that's
sort of a serious discussion. We never finish our discussions at Holden. We always just continue them at coffee break and throughout the day and stuff. you know, hopefully there, you know, there's a lot more we could do with this text, and there's a lot more we could do with this discussion of evil. But now let's finish with some miracles.
Can we tell about the customs?
Yeah, or other ones too.
Well, that's the one that pops into my head. As I said, the Islamic teachers are those that are highly respected are those that are able to call down the blessing of God, the barakah, as they always say, in the situation at hand. And people go to them with all their problems. And a number one problem for many people is that they need to earn money. So often you go to get a miracle of getting more money for yourself in a variety of ways. I talked to one who had just come back from Zaire. And Zaire is a place that there's a lot of smuggling going on. There are diamonds in the country and you can't get them out legally. So even I happened to be in Zaire before, so it was very interesting. I know that Zaireans would find diamonds somewhere and they'd go off to the capital and sell them to Senegalese people. Senegalese people seem to be the most skilled at somehow getting them out of the country. And when I went to Senegal, I found out why. And it's because they're religious teachers, their miracle workers are so powerful. That is totally the explanation that they give. So I was very fascinated one afternoon to spend an afternoon with one of these religious teachers, or maybe miracle workers is a better word in a way,
clearly,
who that was his job. He had gone to Zaire, spent a long time there, and the miracles he did was get people to be able to smuggle their diamonds out, get past the customs agent. So that was a different sort of a miracle from God than the kind that we usually think of. What other ones did I tell you about?
You had stories, many, many stories.
I know, sometimes they have to come up in discussion. But that's what is the one, what I think is kind of evil here is that people demand payment for the working of miracles. And so it's not open to everybody. It's not open to any woman that's bent over that Jesus sees. He reaches out to people with no means whatsoever. And they are usually asking for something in return, of course. But
and that's a criterion used, like in the book of Acts, you see how common miracle working was in Jesus' day. He wasn't by any means the only one doing miracles. There is, we talked about Asclepius is probably the most famous of the Greek healers. And there are huge centers for Asclepius cults where people would come for miraculous healing and found it. Apollonius was another itinerant healer who seemed to have done a lot of good works in people's lives at the very time of Jesus. And you see in the book of Acts there was Simon the magician who was also working miracles, doing magic. You know, there's a fine line between miracles and magic. And one of the things, though, in the book of Acts is that these other people seem to have been making money off their miracles. And I think that is a criterion that you can use as a difference between good and evil miracle working. Is the person asking for payment, are they getting rich? And of course, if we apply that in our present day, you know, with the faith healers, I have to say that they wouldn't necessarily come out on the same side as Jesus in a lot of cases if you look at the wealth that they've amassed for themselves.
What about people who get wealthy from medical healing? Is that also a contradiction of using God's gifts?
Well, what about it?
I mean, I wonder. I mean,
I think it's in the same thing. Okay. Self-aggrandizement.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could shift the focus on that a little differently and talk about the justice in the distribution of medical care.
Yeah, that there are so many people in our world who wouldn't get, you know, if Jesus were a doctor, that the doctors are concentrated in urban areas, upper middle class people can have health care. This woman obviously didn't have a health policy, probably, and, you know, yeah.
And one other thing I'd just like to add about healing in Africa that might be more helpful is that in Zaire, as we've touched on, the cause of an illness is that you're out of right relationship with your community. So part of healing, and I know you who work in hospitals today, work on relationships, and that's a healing that we can all work on.